We're here, we're ready to talk about our favorite mustachioed man.
Yeah, so this is the first episode of Perot Pals that will be about the mysterious affair at Styles. And what will we be doing this episode, Caitlin?
This episode is all about preparing you to read A Mysterious Affair at Styles, Agatha Christie's first Poirot book. So I guess our goal is to just give everyone the context and the background and all the necessary, like, fun facts to really enjoy the reading experience. Am I missing anything?
No, that sounds absolutely okay. Great. For this book especially, it's super important, the context, I think.
Yeah, and it's kind of cool. Like, you and I feel like we're kind of learning all of this as we went, and it would have been nice to hear all of this context before we read it. And so we hope that it can be a bit of a gift to you.
Yes.
But yeah, and that's kind of our hope, is that, like, with this podcast, we can enrich the reading experience of Poirot and kind of give your reading some dimension.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I cannot tell you how many books I've read where I would love it there to be, like, a little book clubby podcast to listen to.
Yeah, because, yeah, you read a book and you're like, oh, I want to talk to someone about it. But even if you are in a book club, maybe no one voted for your book. You haven't had a turn to pick in a really long time. Whatever that is, yeah, we want to be that for you.
The book clubs you've been in, Caitlin, you vote on the books? That's so impressive.
I was in a mother-daughter book club as a child.
Wow.
I think we voted on the books. Is there a different way to do you take turns choosing books? That seems more egalitarian.
Yeah, I think that's a great, great idea. Okay. Ones I've been in have always been, there's somebody who runs the book club and they just decide what book.
You've been in a dictatorship.
Yep, that's exactly right. I got to say, it has its positives.
Which, I mean, again, it's kind of what I just roped you into. I was like, we're reading all the Agatha Christie books. And you're like, okay.
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it? Yeah, that is. I didn't think about it like that. But sure. Yeah.
I'm glad you're willing to go along with all of my, what would I say, demands.
Demands. Demands is a good word. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. No, that's great. Yes. Obviously, happy to be here in the book club.
Yes.
where I am right now tied to a table where, and I can't leave.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. So let's dive into it. I think, like, kind of the biggest thing we can give people to prepare to read this book is just locating everyone a little bit in what's going on in England at the time.
The characters and the tone of the book are definitely of its time, and which is, and it's really good because I don't know a whole lot about World War I. So I'm really looking forward to all of the research that you've done, Caitlin. So I really appreciate that.
Yes. No, I had to give myself a refresher, but it was really helpful because I think you and I were kind of like, what's up with, like, having a Belgian and things like that? And then it turns out that there are reasons kind of why Poirot is Belgian, for example. The book kind of has a bit of tension, I would say, between the realities and the horrors of World War I, and also then this, like, British estate that maybe seems peaceful and kind of worlds away.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch the narrative of the book introduce certain characters based on that experience in the war, and then just kind of jettison it. A little bit, like, yeah. As it continues.
So let's talk about World War I. Just some dates refreshers. You know, Chad, that I love timelines. World War I took place between 1914 and 1918. And The Mysterious Affair at Styles was published only 2 years afterwards in 1920. So we're, like, kind of steeped in the aftermath of this time period. And, you know, as we know, like, the concept of PTSD and things like that were really introduced. So I feel like this is a war that really, like, lingers and sticks with like a generation or generations.
Yes.
In this kind of like new and terrifying way. We were very curious to know about the relationship between England and Belgium, because we have this English setting, the English countryside, but then we also have Poirot, a Belgian refugee. And so we were kind of wondering, like, okay, where does Belgium fit into World War One? And I had kind of forgotten that so much of the front, like the trenches and things like that, I hadn't really realized that, like, a lot of that is taking place in Belgium. And apparently, it's because Germany is trying to, like, if you think about it, we have Germany, and kind of in between Germany and France, we have Luxembourg and Belgium, and Germany is trying to invade France, and the war front actually runs all the way from like western tip of Switzerland, if you can like draw a line, literally kind of drawing a line of trenches, all the way to the English Channel, and it kind of just like moves back and forth.
Wow.
During that time period. Yeah, which is, I hadn't really realized that, like, how stuck in the middle Belgium was.
Yeah.
Same with the Netherlands. And so they're kind of in between these warring powers. And I also learned that the largest group of refugees in British history up till this point were Belgians during World War One. Around 250,000 Belgians fled their country after Germany invaded. That kind of would put Poirot and his nationality kind of at the top of mind for Agatha Christie. Interestingly, too, a lot of Belgian refugees were housed with like kind of friendly or sympathetic British families. Hmm. And so it wasn't necessarily like they're coming there and then trying to build a life for themselves, kind of like how we might think about refugees now, where it's like, and then suddenly you have to like figure out where you live and things like that. A lot of families took them in. There was actually a Belgian town that was established in England called Elizabethville, and it was it housed 6,000 people, and it literally operated as an outpost of Belgium, and like wow. operated with Belgian law. Actually, the British people kind of living around the town were really jealous of the nice living conditions that the Belgians had, because they like ran their lives in a way that was a bit more comfortable.
That's fascinating. Do you think it's also like a thing where like the food was a lot better in the little Belgian thing? Like that must have been happening, right? They weren't just like eating fish and chips. They were probably not that that's what they were doing anywhere else. But like that's so that to think of a little enclave that is just like a sovereign area.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's fascinating. So it sounds also like it's like almost like there's an understanding between different countries that are on the same side of World War One, that it's also because really you're just going across the channel, that this is temporary.
Yeah. Yes.
It's very different than crossing, say, the Atlantic to get to the United States, where we think of like people coming and they start brand new lives here. And
exactly.
Okay. That's fascinating. Wow.
Yeah, that's really true. And so, and a lot of people did return to Belgium afterwards. And so that's kind of maybe a difference too, is that it did feel like it was more like this is a temporary influx of people, but some did stay, like our fictional friend Poirot.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it kind of makes sense that like this is what Agatha Christie was seeing at the time, and this is kind of the world that she's inhabiting and that this book inhabits. And so that's kind of something to think about when you're reading the book, is that it's almost like there is this kind of like dark cloud of terror and horror that is near, but also far. There, I don't know. I get this sense, and like maybe we can even think about that little Belgian town. Like there's this sense of maybe feeling a little safer, but maybe there's some tension that things are still terrifying and uncertain.
I don't know the exact geographical distances, but I think being from the United States sometimes obscures, and I felt this way reading this book, like obscures the kind of realities of a European war. The distance between like London or the countryside where they are in this book And the front can't be that far, even if the English Channel's in the way, right? Like, it's, I can't imagine that it would be almost like, I'm in Chicago. I would imagine that it would be similar to like a massive war happening in southern Minnesota. Oh, yeah. So you feel safe that it's not going to potentially come down here. But in the same sense, it's like, not. Yeah, it's not like living in New York and then having the front be in Berlin.
Exactly. And actually, this is something that I would recommend. And maybe we could even like put out on like social media or somewhere in the show notes too, like a list of maybe like movies or things to watch. I think we had talked about like there's All Quiet on the Western Front.
I think 1917.
1917, yeah. I'm trying to think of other like films that would maybe give you like a good visual of like what was going on at the time. Thinking about our main character, Hastings, who has just come from the front. I think that that's maybe some of the unspokenness, I guess, is what you and I are trying to get at. Is that like Agatha Christie wouldn't have to explain a lot of this because everyone is so steeped in it.
Exactly.
In kind of this background and this context. So the more you can give yourself of what we're to assume these characters have gone through, I think the more it will add dimension to them that she maybe didn't feel like she had to even add.
Right. And I think there's also then the contrast between that and the kind of way that Poirot and British folk conduct themselves even during a time of war creates that kind of like back and forth where the lifestyle can't be changed because to change it would be to lose a certain part of the war. Yeah. Right.
One of my first like kind of big takeaways or like theses coming out of reading this book and also researching it is that I really don't think we would have Agatha Christie's career or Poirot as a character without World War One. Like, I just see them as kind of like inherently linked. You really don't get one without the other.
Yeah.
So I thought we'd take a little bit of time to talk about what's going on in Agatha Christie's life when she's writing this book. And it also does end up informing the plot, but I don't want to give away any spoilers.
Right.
Her life really influences how she writes the book, how she comes up with the plot. So Agatha Christie was married in 1914, so like right before the war broke out, or maybe even during, depending on the month. And so, you know, like the many, like the other, like World War II, you know, it kind of upsets everyone's life and they have to kind of put their marriage on hold. It almost reminds me of like the first Outlander book. Where the main, I don't know if anybody is familiar, where the main character has this like promising marriage and then she has to serve as a nurse, her husband has to serve in the army, and then they come back several years later and are kind of like having this reckoning about like, are we still in love? We're so changed by the war.
Yeah, I I can tell you, Caitlin, and that I have read any number of the Outlander books, so yes. Yes, I'm with you.
You know, yeah.
Okay. I do. I genuinely can back you up. It's very much that feel. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And that will be our next podcast. once we finish with Poirot. But yeah, so anyways, it's...
yeah. We're going to go from...
I mean, we could.
Poirot to Outlander. That's amazing.
Oh my God. There's a lot to talk about there that we won't talk about here. But yeah, so anyways, but luckily, like, it really sounds like Agatha Christie, she and her husband are totally in love. She does say that, like, she really feels like their marriage began in 1918 after the war was over. So she's just kind of on, her life is on pause right now. And so she's like young, she's just been married, but she's working in a hospital because everybody's doing, you know, it's like, do your duty, do your best for the war effort. And she's working in a hospital dispensary, which is important for the plot. So keep that in mind.
Right. Not a marijuana dispensary. It's not for marijuana.
No. Yes. Okay. Yeah. A 1914 dispensary. So probably like just the good stuff. It's full of cocaine. But like she's really bored. Her day to day, not that interesting. She's dispensing medication and that's about it. So her sister gives her a little challenge. She says, I challenge you to write a murder mystery. And I'd love to know more about the origins of that. But her sister gives her this kind of game to play to see if she can come up with a really good whodunit. And so she's working in the dispensary. And as she goes, she starts thinking about and getting inspiration for like how a murder would take place based on the world around her. And she even says that she found her characters while on a tram. So kind of going back and forth to work every day. She's going around, she's observing all the people she sees. And that's really where she pulls all these different people into a plot. This classic kind of isolated murder in a mansion, a cast of people who has committed it. And so she started the book as a weekly serial, which is first published in 1920. And I do think I wrote this as a note to myself, but I do want to challenge myself to read one of the books that we do on this podcast. It would have to be like where we have the time, but to read one chapter a week, almost like a serial, you know, you get it in installments. I think that would be really fun. Cause I think I think the red herrings would be more, they would pull you in. They would be like more distracting. Whereas if you're just like reading the book all the way through, you're kind of like, oh, what's this about a suitcase? Like, what's this about a cup of hot chocolate? Like you can kind of breeze past them a little bit more. Yeah. Whereas I think if you read it week by week, you would like dwell on it a little bit. I don't know. We should challenge ourselves to do that.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So anyways, the book receives, and this is very unusual, but it receives a review in the Pharmaceutical Journal when it comes out because it has some pharmaceutical ties. Agatha Christie was praised for her accurate handling of the science in the story, which is kind of cool.
That's amazing. So if I'm hearing that correctly, mm-hmm. it's that during the war, because of the war being on, she got a job at a dispensary, potentially mm-hmm. because people who were normally would be working there weren't. Is that?
Yeah. And I think a lot of British hospitals housed recovering soldiers.
Okay.
That's a good question.
So that's but it's probably part and parcel of the context, the war
yes.
being,
yeah.
and then she is so good at her job that when she writes a fictional account that takes in that then part of it has to do with where she works, the pharmaceutical industry is like, yeah. you nailed it. This part of the book is great. That's so cool.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
Yeah, they're like, the science is accurate.
That's
like,
awesome.
You did a really good job. Like, this could totally happen. And again, we're trying not, no spoilers here. There will be plenty of spoilers in the next episode, but no spoilers here. Yeah, like, I believe, and I'm trying to envision this, but I believe it was like a military hospital. And I do think that there might have been some German bombings in England as well. Mm-hmm. I feel like I did read it somewhere. So it's definitely like, it's kind of those tracks where it's like, are you helping the war effort? Are you either going to fight? Are you working in agriculture, like feeding people? Or are you working in medicine? You know, kind of like those tracks. Like, what are you doing to support the war effort of the war effort, I guess?
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah. So I want to make sure we cover just a couple more things. But also kind of connected to World War One is Poirot's famous mustache. So I kind of thought, oh, you know, like she's just giving him some character quirks, you know, like every detective needs a thing or two that makes them a little silly and like unusual. But it turns out that there is like kind of a historic validity or kind of it's backed up that Belgians, particularly during World War II, always wore the specific style of mustaches. And so his big mustache is kind of part and parcel with being Belgian.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's not just like she kind of pulled it from thin air. She's really observing what's going on. So yeah, mustaches were a symbol of power and virility during World War One.
We haven't talked that much about other versions and depictions of Poirot mm-hmm. other than these books.
Yeah.
I think probably the most famous TV or film rendition is David Suchet's Poirot. And that mustache is very thin. And
yeah,
Poirot is obviously almost fetishistic about order, right?
Yes.
And so that makes sense. But then, like, I think those Poirots are amazing. But now you have the Kenneth Branagh one, and that mustache is bananas. But is that more what it might have been like, actually?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I have some intel. And this is from Chris Chan, writing on agathachristie.com. The Branagh mustache is much more historically accurate and represents the mustaches that the Belgians were wearing at the time. And this is because King Albert I had a really big mustache. And so everyone was kind of trying to do that. I'm thinking about like how maybe a modern equivalent would be like a Michelle Obama being a fashion inspiration type of thing a little bit.
Oh, wow.
Except it's King Albert I, you know, or I'm trying to think of like fashionable people in politics, like maybe a Meghan Merkel. Maybe,
sure.
You know, and you're like, oh, what are they wearing? And
yeah.
Everyone, it kind of trickles down. It seems similar. And I think,
oh, wow.
I'm trying to think of a modern equivalent, because the thing about Poirot is that his mustache makes sense in this book. And then as the books go on, his mustache stays and men's fashion changes. And so his mustache that used to be super masculine, super cool, it goes out of date. I mean, these books go all the way to the 70s. And so, which is right. Another matter we will look at is like, how old is Poirot? And
sure.
I don't know. I think in this book, I'm guessing at the youngest we could put him is 40.
Okay.
Maybe. But also then somehow he's like, still solving mysteries. Well, I guess if in the 1970s, I mean, he's an old guy by the end, but yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think someone had talked about, oh, I worked with him in Belgium on the police force in 1905. So I'm like, could we even put it back? Could he even be like 35? But like Hastings calls him old. And I'm like, is that because Hastings is really young? Is that because our notions of age have changed? But also he exists in like a time warp.
So you said it was 1905
mm-hmm.
is kind of like when we know might be the earliest date of a Poirot sighting.
Yeah. Yeah. Like if he's in his 20s.
Right.
Then.
So
yeah.
Let's go with that. Because then that sets up like 1920. He would be at the oldest 40 probably.
Yeah.
Right?
But then I guess he's still solving mysteries in his 90s.
Yeah, which I think sounds completely reasonable. Yeah, especially in the 70s, right? Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Sure.
So we'll just say that. Yeah, so he's an older 40. Like, time hasn't been good to him.
Right.
I guess.
Right, it's all the rich food. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, uh-huh, uh-huh. And the war wounds.
Well, oh, sure.
the war, the crimes.
Oh, the stress. Yeah.
But I guess I was trying to think about like what a good equivalent would be for the mustache. Is there something that used to be very popular in men's fashion that like someone would wear now and it would be a sign that you're like aging and out of touch? And it's kind of hard, I think, because fashion now, everything is like come around again and everything can be worn ironically. And
right.
Like it's so ugly, it becomes fashionable. So I'm not sure if it's even possible to come up with an equivalent of something that would be awkward or like clearly like maybe a jort. I don't know.
That's amazing. From from King Albert's mustache to jorts, the first episode of Poirot Pals.
Well, that kind of leads us then to the next thing. We've talked a little bit about fashion, and then the next thing that I was really curious about is the setting. This takes place in Essex. It's on an estate, and it's funny because like estate in like the UK means something kind of different, but we're thinking of like a mansion, kind of like that old money, old fashioned lord and lady in a giant house on a lot of land, which apparently Essex has a lot of. It's a region just north of London, kind of along that eastern coast. And so, of course, you would think across the channel, we get France and Belgium. This is going to sound a little bit like Encyclopedia Britannica, where I got it from, but I think it's helpful. It's traditionally covered in forests, and we do have like a forest featured in like around the grounds. A lot of fertile soil, and so there's a lot of agriculture there, which also plays into it. There's some really interesting stuff with like women taking over agricultural roles, and it's close to London, but it feels rural, especially then.
There is something so fascinating about why these freaking enormous manors exist.
Yeah. So a couple things, though, about Styles and the manor. It seems like, and this is why I feel like there's just so much out of all the books, and I think you and I will get to this when we do our next episode, but there's like a seriousness and almost like a sacredness to this first book, because it's the first one, and it is kind of coming out of this really emotionally traumatic and dark time that I think for the literary world at large, because it was so revolutionary, and then also for Agatha Christie too, because it was her first book, I think that this story has, and this is me editorializing a little bit, but it does seem like Styles means a lot to her. Apparently, I guess I did find this on Wikipedia, so take it with a grain of salt. But apparently Agatha Christie and her husband named their estate. Once they were successful and could afford an estate, they named it Styles. And so like she's living at Styles, and then the last Poirot book, which we will get to in 2030 or whenever we get there.
Right. Yeah, I will undoubtedly be in the hospital, but we can still set something up, right?
Exactly, yeah. Who knows? We'll be like, what wonders will technology provide us? Poirot, in his last book, which I haven't brought, I've read it once, and I was like, I can't read it again until you and I do it together, because I have so many feelings about it.
I have to admit something to you now, Caitlin.
Yeah.
I know we're good friends, and I know that our friendship can handle this, but 2 weeks ago, I couldn't sleep. I had a bout of insomnia, and I didn't want to wake anybody up, so I crept out of bed. And I went into the TV room, and on YouTube TV, I DVR'd and watched the Masterpiece Mystery version of the last Poirot story. And I felt bad when I was doing it. I didn't know what to do. It's one of the reasons why when you've been calling me these last couple of weeks, I haven't been picking up.
You're just like avoiding me. It's the shame, the well-earned shame.
Right. The well-earned shame. And I was just also, I loved it. So that was so hard because I'm like, oh, no. But what I would say is that similar to this, it's dark.
There's a heaviness and dark, it like returns.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And no, it's fine that you can do whatever you want, Chad.
That's very nice of you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. But, and I would let you know if someday I decided you couldn't.
I'm aware. Thank you.
The last book returns to Styles, and we get this sense of like, what would you call it? There's like a gravity to the location.
There's a trope in like for a very long time in film criticism, and I just know it from like the 80s to like the late 90s, but they would be like, you know, and the third star of the film is New York City.
Oh, yeah, the character is really the city.
Right, and that's how it feels. That's how Styles feels.
I hadn't thought about that.
It's very much a character in and of itself.
It's sinister, it's sad, it has a history of maybe horrors, but also holds the history of like the British aristocracy and maybe all of the crimes committed to maintain power and money. But yeah, okay, so I think lastly, just kind of before we let people go, I do think that like, I don't know, like, do you have any like tone setting or like curating your experiences, your reading suggestions for people? If you could redo reading this book, like how would you set things up?
I feel like at the end, like towards reading the last third of the book, I feel like for me, I had kind of really improved on the experience of reading it. There's a little kind of lazy boy like chair that we have. And it took me until then to be like, this is my preferred reading spot. Mm-hmm. Also, I'm not a big fan, as it turns out, of book lights. If they're necessary, sure, if you're reading, but I prefer a dimly lit lamp behind me and to the right a little bit. Not that I'm being specific, but I also took me a very long time to recognize that you had mentioned in the periphery of one of our discussions message-wise that you were going to take notes all over the book. And I tried to do that, but it turns out I need to take notes on a separate yellow legal pad. Also, it took me a little while to figure out people inexplicably in this book seem to drink coffee at night. And so
I don't understand it.
I thought to myself, maybe I should do that. And like I said before, I have insomnia. So smart thinking, Chad. And so I tried coffee a couple times when I was reading at night, was not going to happen anymore. Then I switched to a decaffeinated tea. It took me a little while to figure out, is I like a spicy cinnamon-esque tea that almost tastes like Big Red gum while I'm drinking it. But okay. It also has no caffeine. So
perfect.
That's what I would do. I had my little mug on the little stand next to the lazy boy-esque chair, which is a cheap gray would be the color, and the lamp just behind me and to the right, not bright, never on the highest setting, always like dim. And so I kind of have to lean into that area to read the book. And then on the armrest of the lazy boy is the pen and yellow legal pad. That was
love it.
And by the time it was over, I was like, I think I've streamlined this. This is how I'll be reading all of the books.
Yeah, I do. I think you can decide to like what level you want to read it. I mean, we were preparing for this, of course, but like, I think you can decide and maybe try it out a couple times. But like, are you going to write down all the clues? Are you going to write down all the characters? And are you going to like detective your way through it? Or are you just going to kind of let the story wash over you?
And which do you do?
I mean, the audiobook is the wash over. Or just, I mean, like listening to like the audiobook version of it, you know, it just kind of speeds you through the story. You don't have time to really pause. It just kind of takes you there. So that's one way to do it. But if you do want to like slow down and detect, I would do like a notebook, but also maybe like commit to it, like list of clues, list of characters, which I actually needed. I needed to write down who was who because you get introduced to people so quickly.
Yes.
But yeah, so I think maybe kind of deciding which path you want to take, because you can't decide like halfway through, oh, I should start writing things down.
No.
Because you're going to miss a lot. But yeah, and I think you and I, we created a playlist that is on Spotify that we'll link to. We have different songs for different characters. We definitely curated it, having people reading the book while they're listening to it in mind. So enjoy that if you want some background music. And I do suggest, you're totally right, there's a lot of coffee. And so if it's in the morning, have some coffee with you. If it's in the evening, try a hot chocolate.
Oh, hot chocolate.
Maybe
okay.
Try a hot chocolate with a little bit of rum if you want to emulate some of the characters. Maybe even hot chocolate with a little bit of salt, which will come up in the plot.
Yeah.
And I do think we have talked about doing some like recipes to go along with it. So we'll see if we get that going, because that could be really fun too.
Yeah, I would say the same thing that we'll say in other episodes, which is that if we do these things inevitably to begin with, they will be in the show notes. So while you're listening to this, unless you're driving, then don't do this. When you get a chance, just go, if you're holding your phone now, just go to this episode and then hit information or show notes, and all that stuff will be in there.
You'll see what we accomplish and what we let go of.
Exactly.
But yeah, also, I did have some clues to kind of give people to have fun while they're reading. First, I would say take Poirot literally and pay attention to every word that he says.
Yes.
There's a really great Poirot quote that I wanted to kind of leave people with, which can maybe send them in the right direction. Although, man, like, please send us in your guesses. Like, did you guess it? If you did, oh my God, that's amazing, because it's really hard. But so here's the quote. Here's the guiding quote. Imagination is a good servant and a bad master. The simplest explanation is always the most likely.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So anything else we need to give people before we send them off to read?
Yes, our email address is poiropals@gmail.com. That's poiropals@gmail.com. And we will undoubtedly respond to everything we get.
To every single thing we get. Yeah. Or if you want to send us voice recordings of your thoughts, or if you want to send us like pictures of your reading setup, we'd love to see them and we'd love to share them, kind of just depending on like what the shape of this podcast takes, you know?
Yes.
So yeah.
Awesome.
Yay. Well, with that, happy reading. Happy solving mysteries.
And we'll see you at the next episode where we will give away everything that happens in the books. So
after the end credits, press stop, switch to something else. Listen to some music. Don't go to the next one unless you want everything to be spoiled.
Right. Make sure between the end of this episode, which is imminent, and the beginning of next episode, which we have no control over when that starts, that you have read this book.
Well, I mean, just do what you want. It's your life, but.
Well, right. Exactly. I didn't want to make it sound so grand and almost dark. So I apologize.
It is.
But it is. To a certain extent, it's very serious.
We will know.
Oh, we'll know.
Okay. We have nothing more to give.
We have nothing more to give. But thank you so much for listening. Yes.
Okay. Happy reading. Bye, guys.